Welcome back, everybody, to the Classic Rock Podcast. Now, we've got a bit of catching up to do this month after we dispensed with the newsy items and reviews last month to accommodate that two-part special on Randy Bachman, which, if you haven't heard it, is still available to be heard. And there's some fantastic stories that he came out with, as you would expect, obviously, for somebody who has spent, what, six decades in the music industry. Now, what a 6 weeks it has been of late. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, of course, Mick Jagger having heart surgery. Motley Crue's The Dirt premiered on Netflix and got some amazing reviews. And we said goodbye to a number of old friends, Scott Walker, Bernie Torme, Dick Dale, and very recently, Paul Raymond of UFO. We'll have a little bit more on that later on. Now, hologram tours booming. Frank Zappa's out this year, followed by Dio, and then Roy Orbison, and Buddy Holly as well, doing the rounds later on this year in the UK. Biopics, they're all over the place as well. As we know, Elton John's Rocket Man is coming, but there's also going to be a Sex Pistols biopic, and Tom Hanks has been lined up to play Colonel Tom Parker. That's Elvis Presley's manager, of course, in the biopic about Elvis's life. No actor actually has yet been cast to play Elvis, but whoever does get it, you hope that they get paid well, because it could be a career-ending decision to play the part of the king of rock and roll and getting it all wrong. But it can, of course, be the making, as Rami Malek has found out, of course, after his portrayal of Freddie Mercury. You might have seen that he's now being cast in the next James Bond movie as one of the villains. Now, more on the news in a little bit, but as classic rock finds itself motoring through its seventh decade, I'm taking day one as being, what, the 60s here. There's an anniversary of something or other pretty much every day, far too many to mention. But I thought we would mention a few this month. And we'll start the anniversaries with somebody who celebrated a birthday, and it is one of significance, as this month saw the 74th birthday of one of the finest guitar players these shores have ever produced. His list of achievements is simply way too long to even attempt to try and list. His name is Richard Hugh Blackmore. And to celebrate, Richie's going to open the podcast this month. And to those of you that have seen him over the past few years on the Memories in Rock Tour, you'll know that this has actually opened the shows on a number of occasions. So raise your glasses in a toast and enjoy this, a fine English composition. Richie Blackmore there with his recent version of Land of Hope and Glory. And keep an eye out too for Black Sheep of the Family. They've just had a reworking of that song originally done by Quatermass back in 1970, but then, which appeared on Richie Blackmore's very first Rainbow album in, 76 with Ronnie James Dio. This is a version done with Ronnie Romero and the latest incarnation of the band, and it is really very, very good. Now, as we know, Richie had something of a very dark sense of humour, and there have been many hilarious tales of dark escapades over the years. Now, however, the best of all of them is recounted here by Lemmy.
The best story I ever heard, and I believe it's true, it sounds like Richie. Richie Blackmore was notorious, right, for doing terrible things to people while they were asleep. This tour manager one time pissed him off, and they slipped him a Mickey, right? And he woke up stark naked, without any clothes or papers of any kind, in a hired car with no keys in it, on a ferry to Iceland. And that, I don't care who you are, that is the best I ever heard. That is thorough, you know? And I hope it's true, you know? Because it should be. That is wonderful, and it's malice. And what are you going to do, you know? Ask a sailor for help? Or wait till all the cars start going beep beep behind you when they get into port, you know? Wunderbar. Start bulk naked.
Absolutely brilliant tale there, as recounted by Lemmy of Motorhead. Now, if we ever get Richie Blackmore in interview, that, I can assure you, will be the first question. Who was the promoter that pissed him off? What did he do to piss him off? And whatever happened when that ferry arrived in Iceland? Now, before we leave old Blackers alone to go and celebrate in peace, what are we to make of this image that he portrays? Is he really as moody and as dark as everybody says he is? Well, there's only one person to really ask, isn't there? So, the question is, how would Richie sum up Richie?
I want to be unpredictable, but then I'm predictably unpredictable. Yeah. That's the problem. There's, oh, here's Richie's here. The black clouds above his head, and he's going to be annoyed. And it's like, no, I'm not. I'm very content inside. I just give the impression that I'm annoyed, because it keeps people off my back. If I come in on a scowl, people go, oh, we won't talk to him now. It's a protection thing. It's a cover. It's like, don't talk to me because I'm a nasty guy. Leave me alone. I've seen pictures of me at 5, and I remember distinctly my mother saying, smile for the cameraman. And I'm going, no. How many people can fake a smile? I can't. And I kind of wonder about the people that do.
He often says that he's never really happy, but to get content is more what he's in search of. So
happiness is fun.
He thinks it's fleeting, so he doesn't do happiness. He doesn't do happy, as we the rest of us know it.
I think happiness is a superficial. I'm a bit of an enigma. I thrive on friction with rock and roll. And sometimes even this music, I thrive on rebellion and hating people. And I can love people, but I thrive on the rejection, you know. If I see somebody in the audience going, I'll go, I'll show you. And then I'm all over playing really hard. Whereas if everybody's really happy, I'm like, oh, I'm happy. And I won't go anywhere. You know? So I thrive on friction. And that's been indoctrinated in me for a long time. I don't even know where that comes from. Maybe I'm not going to blame my parents. It wasn't them. I loved horror films. I loved Christopher Lee. I loved all the Hammer horror films. And I thought, wouldn't that be great to have a band that had that effect on people? People went, oh, what's this? This is the dark person. Instead of being Paul McCartney going, everything's fine, everybody. Yeah, he's a great musician. But, you know, that thumbs up is like, That's boring.
I don't
boring.
Think smiling comes naturally, even in personal no. pictures. He doesn't. He just
but smiling doesn't come naturally.
Naturally
to people. It's not a normal thing.
It doesn't come to you.
I'm sure there, you know, that he didn't get the last word. Let's hope we get a new Rainbow album from Ritchie Blackmore. Now, on to some of the more interesting news stories from the last months or so. Scotland's oldest sweet shop has created an interesting new line, the Star Rock Shop, which is based in Kirriemuir, where a certain legendary frontman by the name of Bon Scott spent his formative years. They have produced a new line in honour of the said man ahead of the Bonfest event over the coming weekend, in honour of the 40th anniversary of Highway to Hell. You can now feast on Hell's Balls. You will find them coloured orange and black, of course, to match the colour of flames, and they have a bold flavour like the man himself, sour blackcurrant. Available online, so you can go online and buy some if you can't make it to Bonfest. Now, this is my favourite story of the last month. Jason Bonham has decided to withdraw a statement he made earlier this month about being introduced to cocaine by Jimmy Page when he was 16 years of age. So, picture the scene if you can. It was a hotel room, obviously, and Bonham was quoted as saying, at the time, "We got called to Jimmy's room. I was 16 at the time. There was a woman on the floor with a collar on, meowing, and he had this grinder thing." Now, are you still with me on this, or are you getting a bit waylaid by the meowing woman? Now, he continued. He turned over and said, "Here you go." And I said, "Thanks." He then inquired if I'd ever done this type of thing before. "Oh, yeah," I said. And this was followed a couple of weeks later by a hasty retraction. He called his comments unfounded and untrue. Now, personally, I couldn't care less about the drugs. I just want to know what happened to the meowing cat woman. And there are further questions that need to be asked of Jason. Firstly, did he stroke her? Was she taken for walkies on the leash? Did she eat dry or wet food? And most importantly, what was her name? Lots of new product on the horizon from some big, big names. Keep an eye out for a new Carlos Santana album called Africa Speaks. It's out on June the 7th. It's been produced by Rick Rubin, and he is going to be out on tour this summer with the Doobie Brothers. What a good night that should be. And he'll be celebrating 20 years, seems like yesterday, since his comeback to the big time with that amazing album, Supernatural. Now, with biopics and stage musicals very much in vogue at the moment, who do you think has the catalogue of music with the stories to tell which could translate into a theatrical production? Well, interesting thought. Geddy Lee, formerly, of course, of Rush, now ensconced in semi-retirement, believes 2112 or Clockwork Angels could work. Now think about it, could be something of a Game of Thrones on stage here. And anybody who saw the Clockwork Angels tour, by the way, with that orchestral add-on, it was a memorable night indeed. So keep your eyes peeled in the next couple of years. We could very well have Rush the musical on stage. Lynyrd Skynyrd, yes, the band who have been on the farewell tour for the last 18 months or so, and who are still out on the road and who are coming to Europe. Well, Johnny Van Zandt has made an announcement. A new album is in the can, and they recorded the last ever show in Jacksonville, and they will do a CD, DVD of that as well. And he added, "We're not done yet, as there will be further live outings around the world in Australia, New Zealand, plus there is a to-do list, a bucket list, if you like. And on it, there is a blues record, plus they want to do a gospel album." Plenty of life, it seems, in Lynyrd Skynyrd yet. And remember, they play in the UK this summer, along with Status Quo on the same bill. Now, moving on to the subject of reunions, which always tends to get people a little bit excited. They usually feature over the course of a month as well. This month is no different. John Anderson, very open to a full-on Yes reunion. Now that Anderson, Rubin and Wakeman are on hiatus, he said to me, "A great album has still to be made. That's what I think. I don't know how it will be made, but the final Yes event should happen." Some good news for Metallica fans after the success of the brilliant Hardwired to Self-Destruct album, their best certainly since the Black album. News that the next album will be coming along a lot quicker than the last two, possibly late 2020, early 2021. And staying with Metallica, one album that divided opinion at the time with some fans, I came down on the positive, I have to say, S&M. The live album recorded with the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, well, it will celebrate its 20th anniversary this year, and they are getting back together live to do it all again on September the 6th to celebrate the opening of the Chase Center in San Francisco. It will obviously be recorded, so we might even get an S&M 2 with songs from Death Magnetic Hardwired as well coming into play there. Could turn out to be another great album. Good to see Geezer Butler is back out and about again with Deadland Ritual, which of course is his new band. Now, he was interviewed recently and was talking about meeting Ozzy for the very first time. "Ozzy Zig needs gig," he said. That was an ad placed in a music shop window. Music shop, they were places where people used to go to actually buy music and things that are all but extinct now. Anyway, he went round to his house, but he was out. And later on in the day, Ozzy came round to him. "The door opened," he said, "and there was a skinhead with a factory gown on, no shoes or socks, a chimney brush over his shoulder, and a sneaker on a dog lead. I thought, he's the perfect fit for my band." Last word on Sabbath from Geezer. There have been numerous rumours of one-offs, maybe a festival appearance, but he poured cold water on all of those. He said, "I am totally resigned to the fact that Sabbath is over, except for its legacy." And staying on the subject of Ozzy, of course, we know about his hospitalization, but he is getting better, and all of those gigs that were cancelled have been rearranged for early next year. It is classic interview time, and this month it is linked to a 40th anniversary. Released on April 13th of 1979 was Black Rose, a rock legend by Thin Lizzy, and this is certainly worthy of celebration. The album produced three singles, Waiting for an Alibi, Do Anything You Want to, and Sarah. It went to number two on the UK album charts, produced by the legendary Tony Visconti. Chris Sangaridis, as well, was an assistant producer on that. The band at the time, Scott Gorham, Phil Lynott, Gary Moore, and Brian Downey on drums. Assistants coming from Jimmy Bain, formerly of Rainbow, of course, and Huey Lewis played harmonica. The eagle-eyed of you might remember from the Live and Dangerous era, his band Clover actually played support to Thin Lizzy. Now, anyway, as part of our homage, we're going back to a time where if you lived in the UK, at least, the only sniff of any rock music at all was on the Tommy Vance Friday Rock Show, a musical institution for many of us. Anyway, here is TV on the Radio, as they used to say, with Phil Lynott and Scott Gorham talking about Roisin Dub. That's, of course, Black Rose.
And that's called Do Anything You Want To, and it's by Thin Lizzy. And we have a sizable chunk of Thin Lizzy in our studios this afternoon. We have Phil Lynott and Scott Gorham. Phil, welcome, and Scott, welcome to you too.
Hi. How are you doing, sir?
Nice to see you.
Good to see you too.
Look, the success of the Live and Dangerous album took a lot of critics really by surprise. We've been hearing for a long, long time that heavy metal was dead, finished, and out the window and gone. But did it surprise you that you came out with the most successful Thin Lizzy album at the peak of punk's popularity?
No, not really. I was taken back by the sales because it was a double album, you know, and for it to go platinum, which is our first British platinum record, you know, really surprised us. But the band is very popular, you know, at the moment. And when the album came out, I knew it was going to do well because the supporters had been writing us stacks of letters, you know, saying bring out a live album. And we weren't really against the new wave thing at all, whereas we're a hard rock band, you know. We differ slightly from heavy metal bands, which base their thing on riffs. We sort of base it on songs, and the kids were actually getting off on the song. So in one respect, it didn't surprise me at all. It was just the success of the record really surprised me. Going platinum was the great.
You've had quite a connection with punk, though, haven't you? Or new wave, or whatever you want to call it. And in fact, you've played on various records and assisted in the production of various punk and new wave records.
Yeah, you know, chance me on with anything, you know. Musicians are musicians, whichever name you want to give them, whether it's heavy metal, new wave, hard rock, whichever. I mean, I can remember a time it was progressive and underground, and, you know, so, I mean, the names that the critics give it has nothing to do with, like, what actually goes on. If it's good, the kids will like it, you know what I mean?
All right. Scott, how's the current tour going down as far as you're concerned?
Well, it's going down great. I mean, we've got, 30 days now, and they're completely sold out. The audiences have been amazing. I don't know what we expected, really, on this tour, but all I know is it's going down really nice. We're starting to play a lot of the new songs off the new album as sort of a feeler to see how they're going to go down. Mm-hmm. And those are going down really well. And that's always kind of a scary situation to be in, like what's going to happen with the new songs, how are the people going to react to it, to something that they've never heard before. Mm. And luckily for us, they've been going down really well.
One of the things that goes along with the tour, and in fact with the whole rock and roll circus, is the merchandising side, the t-shirts, the photographs and things like that. Mm. Do you actually control what happens in that area?
Well, we have official programs and badges, which we take a lot of time over, making sure that the kids get quality and value for the money, you know. But there's a lot of pirates going around, and they just sell, like, really trivia stuff. I mean, I've seen sort of photographs that I could take better myself, you know, and they sell them for £1 a go. Or, like, I've seen pictures of the band with Eric Bell in it, you know what I mean? Like, that was three bands ago, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'd recommend to the supporters to get the official stuff, because at least that's been checked by us.
Rip off.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the new album, Black Rose. There's a track on it that's captivated the imagination of all of us in the studio here, where we hadn't heard it before. A track called Got to Give It Up, which is quite involved.
Yeah, well, that's me alcoholic song. You know, every morning, like, when I get up with a hangover, I found I kept saying, oh, I've got to give it up, or I find myself smoking a cigarette and going, oh, I've got to give this stuff up, you know what I mean? And I wrote a song, so now it's become my little anthem every morning when I wake up. I sing this song in the bath. You know?
Phil Lynott and Scott Gorham from Thin Lizzy in our studio at the moment. Phil, I'd like to ask you, how far is Lizzy your band? Because to a very great degree, you're the guy that's always in the spotlight. Is it a dictatorship or a democracy or what?
I'm seen as the leader of the band, you know, mainly because, you know, if there's a photograph going, I'll jump in front of the camera, you know, or if there's an interview, I'll turn up for the interviews. Whereas I'm seen to be the front man of the band and everything. When it comes to arranging the songs and everything, it's a band decision, you know. Mm-hmm. And if we're making a decision on, say, the program or the album cover or something, it's always a band decision. Even when I bring down, say, a song I've written, like, the arrangement of that song will be a band decision. So I'd say it's more a democracy. We're really like a unit, you know, much more so than people think, you know. I mean, Brian Downey has as much power over decisions that affect the band, and Scott, you know, and Gary, than I do. I'm just seen to talk a lot, you know what I mean?
A chatty Irishman, that's what it is. It's the blarney. Would you agree with that, Scott? Or, I mean, you have a go at him if you like now.
No, I mean, I don't think it really makes any difference to anybody else in the band who's the leader or who isn't, just as long as everything gets done the way everybody wants it done, you know.
Mm. For quite a long time, one got the impression that you had probably the shortest guitar lead in history, because you were standing up against the stacks and you would never come to the front.
So yeah, he had to keep giving me a boot in the butt there to get me out in front.
Why was that?
Well, I think when you first get in a band like this, it takes a while to get courage up to play in front of a lot of people, and it took me a while just to get up the confidence and the courage to actually get up there and say, hey, it's okay, you know, I don't mind people listening to me or watching me or whatever. Mm. It's no problem anymore. I just have a hell of a lot of fun at it.
And that's pretty evident when you're on the stage these days. There's no criticism here of Brian Robertson, but your current colleague, Gary Moore, is, let's face it, one of the greatest British players. Mm-hmm. Is there any competition when the two of you are on the stage?
Yeah, but I think it's more of a friendly competition there. It gives that little bit of an edge to the whole thing. You're always trying to better yourself the whole time as a player and a entertainer or whatever, you know. It just makes it a lot more fun. I mean, if the whole thing was really nice and cheesy and all that up there, it'd become really blasé and no sort of no fun anymore. So we're both giving each other this little competition number going down. Yeah. But we never carry it so far as it's going to hurt Thin Lizzy, you know, I mean, we never let it get in the way, like the big ego trips and things like that. We just go out and, like, have fun with each other and see what happens each night, you know.
Yeah. Phil, about solo albums, there's a little buzz going around that you might actually attempt one yourself.
Yeah, well, I've been trying to get one together for about the last year, but Lizzy keeps taking all my best material, you know, so I've only got about half an album done, but I'm hoping, fingers crossed, you know, to get it finished by the end of this year. I'll get a single out, definitely. Mm-hmm. And I've been paid money for it, so like to be looking for it.
Under an obligation, are you? Well, while we wait for that solo album to arrive on the scene, tell us a little bit about Black Rose, the current album, and what's the song all about? I believe it's got some Irish historical meaning.
Yeah, I mean, it's based on legends. I wrote the number about 2 years ago, you know, and I tried to get as many legends and myths and good things about Ireland in it, you know, like there's a line of Georgie knows best and Oscar's so wild and it was a joy that Joyce brought to me. And Gary had a few jigs and reels that he knew, him being Irish as well. He added a bit to it and he had a few original Irish things that he'd come up with. And it ended up being like the longest track on the album and the hardest for us to work out, you know. So consequently, we gave it the title track. I mean, Roisin Dubh is the Irish for Black Rose or Dark Rosaline, which is a name they had for Ireland in the old days during the Troubles, you know.
Sure.
And the poets, and like when they'd write about Ireland, they'd call it My Dark Rosaline or Roisin Dubh, you know, and that was basically where the idea came from.
Okay, let's play the title track from the album Black Rose, and it's nice to hear that Waiting for an Alibi has gone silver in this country, which I believe is your first silver single for some time.
Yeah, I'd like to thank all the Lizzy supporters for that. Thanks again.
Well, you count me amongst them anyway.
Great interview. Takes you back, doesn't it? Scott Gorham and Phil Lynott talking to Tommy Vance. And that interview found on a cassette, I think. Remember back in the day when we used to stick a tape into your tape recorder, or if you had a radio cassette, if you were very upmarket, and just stick it next to the radio and just record things that were coming out of it. I keep coming across old cassettes with things on, you know, no label. So you stick it into a tape player. And I found a Gillan at Reading the other day. And Tommy Vance introducing David Coverdale and Whitesnake at Donington in 1990. That was actually BBC Radio streaming Monsters of Rock live that year. Well, we're now going to take a little time out to remember friends who have passed away in recent weeks. And just how poignant was UFO's Last Orders tour, as just days after it concluded, the keyboard player Paul Raymond died after suffering from a heart attack. Now, he and the band had been on magnificent form over the previous month. I saw the very first show of the Last Orders tour, and they were quite superb. There was a US tour to look forward to as well later on this year. Now, he enjoyed a fantastic career which spanned six decades. His first brush with stardom was in the 1960s when he had a top 10 hit in the UK with a band called Plastic Penny, who recorded a version of Everything I Am. And he actually replaced Christine McVie, then in Chicken Shack, when she went off to Fleetwood Mac, and then he was off to Savoy Brown. It was in 1976 when the relationship began to fall apart with Savoy Brown that he teamed up with UFO. He actually met Pete Way when they were on the same bill, and after a couple of beers and a conversation and a cup of tea, he joined the band. The rest was history. He will be sadly, sadly missed. Bernie Torme recently passed away as well due to complications after he suffered pneumonia, and he was one day short as well of his 67th birthday. Now, he first came to prominence for a great many of us in the late 70s and the early 80s when he was with the Gillan Band, and they had tremendous success, didn't they? Three albums, Mr. Universe, Glory Road, and Future Shock, all of which spawned a great number of hit singles. Remember seeing him on Top of the Pops, Sleeping on the Job, New Orleans, No Laughing in Heaven, and also a great version of Stevie Wonder's Living in the City. Now, from there on, he went to work with Ozzy Osbourne. He briefly replaced, remember, Randy Rhoads, who also tragically died in that plane crash. Now, Ozzy was one of the first to lead the tributes. He said, Bernie was a gentle soul with a heart of gold. Ian Gillan followed up as well by saying, very, very sad and upset to hear that Bernie has passed. Great respect to the man as a man and a player. He said, give him hell up there, Bernie. No laughing in heaven. Well, there is now. And also a name that you might think that you're not familiar with, Dick Dale. Now, he was the man who was responsible for what they called surf rock at the time. And this isn't to be confused with the Beach Boys, of course, who sung about surfing songs. Leo Fender, he of Fender Guitar and Amps fame, once asked him, why is it you have to play so loud? He'd blown up about 50 of Fender's amps at that time, and he was instrumental in getting them to produce amps that could handle increased volumes. A bit like Spinal Tap, you know, turning up to 11. All in all, he produced 9 albums over his career, beginning with Surface Choice in 61 and ending with Spatial Disorientation in 2001. And you're sitting there going, yeah, yeah, I still haven't got a clue who this is. Well, have a listen to this. And this is one that made him famous. Late, great Dick Dale, and that song, Misilu, which is a Mediterranean folk song, the earliest version of which was actually recorded in 1927. Back to the news, couple of interesting things. Martin Scorsese's Bob Dylan documentary charting the 1975 Rolling Thunder review tour has got a release date on Netflix. It'll be airing from June 12. Now, on top of this, there is a 14-disc CD box set to go with it as well. Now, this tour, remember, saw performances from Joan Baez, Joni Mitchell, and Ringo Starr, amongst others. Should be one to see. Now, there are world championships, it seems, for just about everything that you could possibly think of. Somebody, remember, dreamt up chess boxing, a game of chess, interspersed with a round of boxing. But whilst that is a little left of field, it is nothing to compare with this. Dreamt up in Finland, which is where it is going to be taking place, on July 11th. It is the inaugural Heavy Metal Knitting Championships. Yeah, so adorning the stage, heavy metal bands alongside members of who are knitting. The knitter becomes part of the band, so whilst the vocals are wailing around the arena, alongside will be somebody literally knitting. So if you're short of something to do on July 11th, then look it up. It is time for the Vintage Press Review to return. And this month, we head back in time 14 years, the front cover of classic rock. This month was Pink Floyd, also Jimi Hendrix from 69, a Grand Funk Railroad, the greatest band, they say, that most people outside of the USA knew little or nothing about. Probably true, actually. Meanwhile, in the news, Sabotage at the Ozfest. Sharon Osbourne admitted staging egg-throwing incidents on stage and various invasions before Iron Maiden set all manner of shenanigans going on, including perhaps the funniest, which was Iron Maiden refusing to pay a fee to have their name on the official T-shirt. So the words Iron Maiden were written in Japanese and crossed out with a red circle and a slash. Brilliant. Jimmy Page was working on a new album. 14 years later, he's still working on it. Big crowds in Dublin as the statue of Phil Lynott was unveiled on his 56th birthday by his mother, Philomena, who called it the proudest day of my life. Story behind the classic album cover was Freeze All Right Now. Ron Raffaelli was the guy that was responsible for it. He got his big break being invited onto the Jimi Hendrix first full US tour back in 1968. Jimi Hendrix was allegedly convinced they'd been friends in a past life. Anyway, how did he shoot that infamous cover? Well, he stacked four wooden boxes about 4 foot high, got an 18-year-old model called Linda Blair, not that one. She took a flying leap from a ramp onto the top of the boxes, naked, whilst he lay underneath and shot. They created the silhouette on the cover, and the background is part of a photograph of the California sky, which was taken from his studio rooftop. And there you have it. There was a bit more to it than that, but I think you get the gist. In the obituaries column this month, Bob Moog, the inventor of the Moog synthesizer, passed away. He was 74. And then so too a great piece on Jimi Hendrix's appearance at Woodstock. And it's ironic, part of the reason I included it this month was because of the fact there's all sorts of claim and counterclaim that is going back and forth about whether the 50th anniversary of Woodstock is actually going to take place this year or if it's called off. So just to try and get a handle on a few of the basic facts about Woodstock, they went through this piece. There were 60,000 ticket holders originally. However, 800,000 people actually tried to get there. 200,000 gave up and went home. And despite it being 100 miles only north of New York, it took 10 to 12 hours to actually get there. Friday the 15th, 186,000 tickets were sold. Twice that many were there after the fences were pulled down and it was declared a free festival. On the Saturday, it was estimated 450,000 were there. And if you can imagine, there was a grand total of just, this is for 450,000, 600 Portaloos. Yeah, 600. Official stats for the weekend, 3 deaths, 2 births, and 400 seeking medical attention for bad acid trips. The organizer's response to this was to produce leaflets onto how to survive. This is real, by the way. The first of 2 handy tips of how to survive a bad acid trip was avoid the light blue acid and do not run naked in the sun. They didn't add whether it would be all right to run around in the rain and roll in the mud, but just no sunshine. Now back to Jimi Hendrix. He was last on the bill. When they arrived, he and the band, he was told that they were 3 hours behind schedule, when in fact they were a total of 9 hours. Now, they were offered a midnight slot, and he actually said no. He wanted to close the show. So the closing act of Woodstock actually appeared at 8:30 on Monday morning, when just 40,000 remained. And when he walked off stage, he basically collapsed. He'd allegedly been up for 3 days straight without a single moment's sleep. There was also a piece on Les Paul, who made the humorous assertion that 95% of the world actually think of me as a guitar. Les Paul did actually get a few mentions by Randy Bachman in the special that we did last month. He didn't get to see them. Neil Young, however, did. Paul was, of course, a huge star in the 1950s with Mary Ford, and he went on to win as well, no fewer than 5 Grammy Awards. The big feature of the month was Pink Floyd and the story of when Roger Waters left Floyd in 85. All the more poignant, I suppose, due to the fact that he's recently appeared on stage with Nick Mason's Saucerful of Secrets. Now, back in 85, it was about as acrimonious as it could possibly get. Waters left. He thought Floyd would fold, but they didn't. Then the battle for the name, and indeed, the battle for the pig began. Nick Mason summed it up at the time. He said, Roger was fond of saying that nobody is indispensable, and he was right. Waters was quick to send in the lawyers, and they commenced a high court action to dissolve the Pink Floyd partnership. As he put it, they were a spent force creatively. What the remaining members did, of course, was they dug their heels in and recorded another album. And as we said, then there was the custody of the pig. Now, on being asked about the fan reaction at the time to Waters not being there, Nick Mason simply replied, "Listen, we get more people asking where Sid is." And then both Waters and Floyd set out on a North American tour, with many comparisons being made. Things sort of found a conclusion on Christmas Eve, it was said, in 1987, where Waters met Gilmour in his houseboat and they agreed a deal. Floyd would carry on, Waters would get the wall, plus various stage effects. And as for Mr. Pig, well, he stayed with Floyd. And as Hugh Fielder noted at the time, Pig has a tattoo. Original Pig concept, R. Waters. That you will find is tattooed into his nether regions. And that, ladies and gentlemen, brings us to our final piece for the evening. We talked about this being the anniversary edition, and our final noteworthy anniversary this month is a 39th anniversary for what is, for some, Black Sabbath's best ever album, Heaven and Hell, whilst for others, it doesn't have Ozzy, so therefore it doesn't count. These, of course, all superfluous arguments, because it is the only Sabbath album, remember, that went gold in the UK. It sold over 1 million in the USA over the years as well. And who will ever forget hearing Ronnie Dio's epic performance, perhaps his finest ever? And I distinctly remember the first time I heard this. It was a Sunday afternoon listening to the Top 40 show on the radio. And this literally ripped through the speakers, and still for me today, this one of the greatest heavy metal, hard rock, whatever you want to call it, tracks of all time. So, are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin. Oh no, here she comes again. Can't remember when we've been so close to love before. You know how it goes. Sing along if you can, if you're brave enough. And we'll see you again next month.